You're listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.
I'm Ken Brecker, the president of the Library Foundation, and welcome. We're very happy to have you here. Astonishing, a revelation, polyphonic, a new kind of Native American epic. You've read the news. That's what people are saying. The universal praise for Tommy's book. It's extraordinary. Tommy Orange is redefining. Someone said he's redefining Native American writing. I said, excuse me. He's redefining American writing. It's absolutely fantastic. There has just been long listed for the National Book Award, which I think is great. And it's clear that the world is listening to him. Tommy Orange's visit tonight follows recent appearances on this stage. Many of you were here from peer indigenous authors such as Lely Long Soldier, Natalie Diaz, and Therese Marie Mayat. The Library Foundation is very lucky to be showcasing these essential voices. And in turn, we thank you, the audience, for being here, for getting here. Tommy Orange is a recent graduate from the MFA program at the Institute of American Indian Arts. He's a 2014 McDowell Fellow and a 2016 Writing by Writers Fellow. He's an enrolled member of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma. And he was born and raised in Oakland, California. Someone said tonight it's the new Silver Lake, which is amazing. I thought Brooklyn was the new Silver Lake, or Silver Lake is the new Brooklyn. And he currently lives in Angels Camp, California. And with him tonight on the stage, another great author. We're so lucky. Rigoberto Gonzalez is the author of What Drowns the Flowers in Your Mouth. And I learned tonight from him that that's a quote from Pablo Neruda. Such a beautiful title. What Drowns the Flowers in Your Mouth, A Memoir of Brotherhood, and four books of poetry, most recently Unpeopled Eden, which won the Lambda Literary Award and the Lenore Marshall Prize from the Academy of American Poets. His 12 books of prose include two bilingual children's books, three young adult novels in the Mariposa Club series, and the wonderful Butterfly Boy, Memories of a Chicano Mariposa, which received the American Book Award from the Before Columbus Foundation. Rigoberto is the professor of English at Rutgers Newark, the State University of New Jersey, and the inaugural Stan Rubin Distinguished Writer in Residence at the Rainer Writing Workshop. And recently he did a program for us, which some of you were at the Broad Museum, which was just an extraordinary night. And I can't tell you how exciting it is to be on the stage with these two great, great American writers. And they will be with us afterward. Both of them will have their books ready to sign for you if you wish. So please welcome to our stage the marvelous Tom and Rigoberto Gonzalez.
Buenas tardes, buenas noches. How is everybody? Yeah, wonderful. Such an honor to be here with Tommy. Such an honor to be part of this program. And I wanted to just take 1 minute to acknowledge two of the people that were very much integral in bringing us here with this wonderful programming. And those are the important components of this library and also this Aloud series, and that's Maureen Moore and Louise Steinman. So I just wanted to shout them out. So, Tommy, how are you doing?
Doing all right.
We're having, I almost wanted to have a conversation about what we're having in the green room. We talked about everything from TV to books, but actually I want to begin with one of those anecdotes. And, we talked about coming from communities where the writer is such an unexpected creature in some ways, and other ways it's the perfect place for such a creature to live and exist and thrive. In the Latino community, in my community, my parents, my grandparents did not read or write, and yet here I am as a writer. And I wanted to ask you to tell me a little bit more about that, about your role as a writer, a Native American writer, and in your community. What has that, what have been some of the discoveries and challenges of that new role that you're taking?
So I didn't grow up a reader or a writer or dreaming of being one. And my parents didn't read, and this was the Bible. And by the time I got into it, I was much older, and reading Native writing, what I could find, when I realized I loved reading, which was way late, was very much reservation-based and not the experience living in the city that I had. And, you know, my dad didn't grow up on the reservation, but it was a very similar experience. Mm-hmm. And he just very much was not the reading type, but always an engineer. And there's a lot of TV on growing up, and just not an academic environment. It was very, both of my parents were crazy about God in different ways. Yeah. And so by the time I got to reading and wanting to read, the sort of burning hole of meaning was empty, because what they'd wanted me to believe in was not what I wanted to, you know, not what I ended up getting into. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up getting into a lot of South American writers initially, like Borges specifically, because I first started reading philosophy and all the spiritual texts because I was searching for meaning. And Borges is such an amazing bridge between philosophy and fiction, because what he's doing is, you know, it's very much that. Yeah. And then I got into Cortazar and Adolfo Bioy Cáceres. And
why do you think you connected with those particular authors from Latin America, and you read them a translation?
Yeah, and that was always an issue for me too, an issue of insecurity, because one of the first writing groups I got into, I was explaining who I loved, and it was a lot of South American writers. Yeah. And they were like, oh, you only read translation? And I was like, yeah. And they're like, you're not reading. And yeah. I was like, oh. I think, and I don't know why, and maybe you have an answer, the way a lot of South American writers that I love dig into meaning and aren't afraid to be magical, and the way they're able to build worlds that that feel, I don't like magical realism, but the way that they're able to make something beautiful and mm-hmm. surreal mm-hmm. out of normal, everyday stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't know what I love about it, but that was very appealing to me. And, well, and I think there's a Native component to that that crosses.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what I was going to say. That there's something about, you know, the Americas, right? I mean, mm-hmm. that's something else that we, that many of us have in common in that direction on the map, is like from the north all the way to the south, is that we are connected mm-hmm. through our indigenous identities to the Americas. So it's got to be something there, even if it's just that, you know, that unnameable, intangible energy or force or something. It's there. Right?
And I think ultimately, looking back, because I wasn't conscious of it at the time, but the fact that, you know, South America, Central America, Mexico, mm-hmm. The fact that anybody's brown mm-hmm. just points to Indian blood.
Right.
And all the different narratives that come out of, and the different colonized tongue and whatever stories that come out of that. Mm-hmm. I think I was probably like connecting to something that I didn't know I was connecting mm-hmm. to.
I want to bring it right to the book. And I want you to read these passages on page 38 and 39. This is where you get the discussion of Gertrude Stein, right? And the title.
The quote is important to Dean. This there, there. He hadn't read Gertrude Stein beyond the quote. But for Native people in this country, all over the Americas, it's been developed over, buried ancestral land, glass and concrete and wire and steel. Unreturnable covered memory. There is no there there.
How did you first encounter Gertrude Stein yourself?
So much like Dean, I was wanting a grant from the city of Oakland.
Yeah.
And I would love to say that like I've read all of Gertrude Stein's works, but honestly, I think she's brilliant, but her sentences are dizzying and it's hard to hold cohesion. So I think, you know, I respect her, but how I discovered her was researching what authors there were who had anything to say about Oakland, which there are a few.
Yeah.
A few novels about Oakland, few people have anything to say about Oakland. You probably could spend the rest of your life trying to read quotes about New York from famous authors.
Right.
You probably wouldn't be able to get there. Mm-hmm. But Oakland, very little. And so I came across this Gertrude Stein quote, and immediately when I read her saying there is no there there about Oakland, which despite the fact that it's been, you know, abused to talk about how Oakland has no character, right. People who conveniently want to take over Oakland and be like, there's nothing there there anyway.
Mm-hmm.
What I immediately recognized was the metaphor for native people.
Right.
And so she came back. She grew up in Oakland. She came back and it had been developed over and was no longer recognizable. So she was like, there was no there there. And she writes about in everybody's autobiography. And for native people, you know, trying to figure out the there of wherever you are, but right. Specifically for Oakland and people who grew up in the city and trying to feel like you belong somewhere and you can relate to your environment, the there, there, how do you make sense of it? Yeah. And how do you feel like that is your environment? How do you belong to that when everything that's been written about natives is historical and it's the land and it's reservation-based?
Right. And there's so much there, here, in this book. And before I continue, just to remind you not to give away any plot spoilers, that's also a reminder for me, right? Because I've been to these talks and somebody gives away the ending. So we're going to try to skirt away around them. But I want to say something about the ending, though. And I'll just, but I'm not going to give it away. I'm not going to give it away. Is that, let me tell you, and I said this to my friend over the phone when I was reading your book. I said, the only time that I've ever been through that experience where I had to continue to the end. I had to continue to the end. I couldn't stop reading because even though I kind of knew what was going to happen, right? It reminded me of the experience I had reading In the Time of the Butterflies by Julia Alvarez, where you know the fate of these women and you are still leafing through. And I think part of that is an expectation that it's not going to end up the way you think it's going to end up. But so I don't want you to speak about the ending. I just did. I did it for you right there. But I did want to talk to you a little bit about or ask you about the choice, some of the choices you made in writing this book. The first one is about the multiple character point of view. And, you know, we have Louise Rodrich, who has a whole body of work around the same characters and the generation of characters. And then one book, it's one of my favorites, even though it's so, and I put this one alongside that one as well because of its devastating nature of the narrative, and that's Leslie Marmon Sokol's Almanac of the Dead. But for you, what informed that decision to make a multiple character point of view?
So it was books like Love Medicine, but also Colin McCann's Let the Great World Spin, Marlon James's Brief History of Seven Killings. It was all, you know, it wasn't, once I realized, it didn't take that much. Once I realized, oh, you can do a bunch of different voices and have a cohesive narrative that is one vision, mm-hmm. I fell in love with the concept. Like, one of the biggest critiques that I've heard is, like, there's too many people, I can't keep track.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually love that. And before I even knew what I wanted to write about, because I was writing a lot of weird stuff, because I've been influenced by a lot of weird writers.
Mm-hmm.
Once I started including my own details and stuff that I've experienced and people in my community, those two things came together.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the idea to write from a lot of different voices with one singular vision that you sort of, through the experience of the book, come to find the meaning and connections of. I just love that experience as a reader. Mm-hmm. And I think, true to life, like, what do we experience? A multi-voice narrative mm-hmm. that we have to try to make sense of. Like, yes. This is what life is made of. We have all these voices. Some are more main character than others. And we have to try, do we have to do our best to try to make sense? How does this all make sense into one thing? And does right. life braid it together? That depends on who you are.
Yeah.
But I just like it as a form for mm-hmm. the novel. And so that's kind of, it came first mm-hmm. from a craft, an artistic point of view. Mm-hmm. And then once I decided I'll include what matters to me and what's personal to me, mm-hmm. and those two things came together.
Yeah. And maybe on that note, since we brought up, both brought up Louise Rodrich, so do you envision yourself revisiting some of these characters again in a future project? Because there's so many here that are favorites of mine. I'm sure every reader is going to latch on to those characters that they really identified with or they really wanted to champion. Are we going to ever see some of these characters again?
So when I was writing it, it was definitely just its own thing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, sold it and found out it was going to become a book.
Yeah.
And still, you know, I'm thinking about, there's another novel that came about when I stopped writing this,
yeah.
and I realized gaping hole of I need a book to be working on or else I'm empty sort of yes. feeling. But out of nowhere, actually, after a library conference in Philadelphia, I was digging into old files for this book, and I found something that I thought I was going to read to the librarians. I did. Fill 10 minutes, and I was like, I don't want to just talk because I yeah. hate that. Let me just read something.
Uh-huh.
So I found something that seemed to fit, and that led to something else, which led to something else, which led to book two, yeah. which is very real now, and I'm like 150 pages in,
all right.
and I have a deadline with my agent for like 50 pages next week.
All right.
So it's yeah. happening.
You must be really not stressed right now then. Sitting here, oh, I'm just going to chat for an hour here.
No, I'm happiest if I have something to work on. Okay. I feel most miserable if I don't.
Another important choice you made in writing this book was that the prologue and the interlude,
uh-huh.
right? Those two are markedly nonfiction, and I thought of two other books. You know, that's how I read. I'm always thinking of other books because I believe that even if the books are not necessarily in conversation with those, as a reader's making those connections. And so I thought of two other books. One was Sonia Sotomayor's memoir, which included a chapter about the history of Puerto Rico. And I remember reading and thinking, well, why is she doing that? Because don't we all know? Like, no, we don't all know mm-hmm. the history of Puerto Rico, mm-hmm. right? And the other book was Gino Diaz, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, with those footnotes mm-hmm. that give the history of Trujillo and the Dominican Republic dictatorship. And so for you, what informed or what was the why did the choice to open with such a very dramatic, you know, nonfiction narrative with the introduction.
So, again, with the form of the book, the initial impulse was artistic. I love what prologues do,
yeah.
The way they contextualize story, and certain novels that I've read, I just love the way it sets it up. Also, that if you don't love prologues, you can skip it. And if you're interested later, yeah. you can go back. I think that's yeah. a really nice choose your own adventure quality to it. So I just like that. I've been deeply impacted by prologues. So before I knew what kind of prologue, I was like, I want to write a prologue to the novel that I want to write. Mm. And then once Oakland, which very few people have written about, and urban native people, once I realized neither one had been written about, I knew that the prologue was going to have to introduce what is an urban Indian. And to explain that story, you have to go back one step to relocation. And yeah. to understand what relocation is, you have to understand about genocidal policy before you before you can get into genocide policy, you have to go back to what genocide even is before it became just policy and sort of insidious,
right.
Before, you know, when it became like sort of underground and understated. So what I didn't want to do, because I was writing it for Native people in general and Native people from the city,
right.
Didn't want to hit them over the head with information they might already know.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to write a really compelling thing that talked about, in an interesting way, talked about history and how we came from this to living in this city.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt that was important to contextualize all the characters. And like I said, writing for an audience I thought might already know, so wanting to write it in such a way that even if you already knew the information, it's still compelling.
Right.
So that's kind of where the impulse came from.
Right. There's going back to point of view, most of these stories are in first person and in third person, but there's one that stands out in the second person. That's Thomas Frank, right? Let's see if I can find it real quick. It's on page 208. And I wanted to hear in your voice. Oh, by the way, have you listened to the audio version?
I have.
What do you? Because I played it for my class, and I think that hearing that prologue was a very different visceral experience than even reading it. I don't know if you. What do you think of the audio?
I really like the audio. I had kind of a say in the cast selection, and the main guy who does most of it and does the prologue is a First Nations guy. He was on a TV show about a guy trying to make a documentary about urban Indians.
Interesting.
So when I heard that fact,
yeah,
I was like, it's cosmic. Can't not have him be the guy.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask you to read the first paragraph of the Thomas Frank section. Just so we can hear the second person point of view.
So Thomas Frank is my first and second name. I go by Tommy.
Oh, interesting.
So this was sort of like this whole thing came out in like 10 days in a rush to make sure to get in the book, it felt. This isn't, you know, it's a blend of fact and fiction. But just so you know.
Okay.
I'm reading up until... here?
Yeah.
Before you were born, you were a head and a tail in a milky pool, a swimmer. You were a race, a dying off, a breaking through, an arrival. Before you were born, you were an egg in your mom who was an egg in her mom. Before you were born, you were the nested Russian grandmother doll of possibility in your mom's ovaries. You were two halves of 1,000 different kinds of possibilities, 1,000,000 heads or tails, flips shine on a spun coin. Before you were born, you were the idea to make it to California for gold or bust. You were white, you were brown, you were red, you were dust. You were hiding, you were seeking. Before you were born, you were chased, beaten, broken, trapped on a reservation in Oklahoma. Before you were born, you were an idea your mom got into her head in the 70s to hitchhike across the country and become a dancer in New York. You were on your way when she did not make it across the country, but sputtered and spiraled and wound up in Taos, New Mexico at a peyote commune named Morningstar. Before you were born, you were your dad's decision to move away from the reservation up to northern New Mexico to learn about a Pueblo guy's fireplace. You were the light in the wet of your parents' eyes as they met across that fireplace in ceremony. Before you were born, your halves inside them moved to Oakland. Before you were born, before your body was much more than heart, spine, bone, brain, skin, blood, and vein, when you just started to build muscle with movement, before you showed, bulged in her belly, as her belly, before your dad's pride could belly swell from the side of you, your parents were in a room listening to the sound your heart made. You had an arrhythmic heartbeat. The doctor said it was normal. Your arrhythmic heart was not abnormal.
Thank you. You know, that there's so many beautiful moments in the book, and as we follow all these characters moving towards a powwow, I mean that becomes like the pivotal moment of this reunion and all of the expectations that these characters have, and they all have different reasons for going to the powwow, right? Some are so heartfelt, some are insidious, others are confusion. And it seems one thing that you really tap into is this notion of identity, right? Identity becomes so important. And there's a passage here, or there's a quote, page 119, let me find it. And this is when this Orville, who's been looking at the YouTube videos to learn what a powwow is and how to dance, he's going to go dance. And then his auntie or his grandma.
Yeah, yeah.
And it says, let me make glasses. She says, "Don't ever let anyone tell you what being Indian means. Too many of us died to get just a little bit of us here, right now, right in the kitchen. You, me, every part of our people that made it is precious. You're Indian because you're Indian because you're Indian." And that, you know, that part of your quote just resonated every single time, especially with that passage and Thomas Frank's story. But one thing I want to, and so there's this idea of holding on to story, memory, history, the bloodlines, all that was essential to preserve. There was a huge responsibility no matter who you are, right? And yet there's an element that you bring in that really was startling, which was technology. You know? And without the plot spoiler at the end, right, technology plays an important role there. But before that, it was like Facebook plays an important role. And at one point, the YouTube videos play an important role, right? So why that particular thread in this, in the texture of the narrative, technology?
So most people either know or will immediately know when I reference that the way we think of Indians or Native people is historical, as in deep history, like we don't exist anymore, or historical, like we're still on reservations. And, you know, just today, this morning, my Lyft driver to the airport, because this comes up every time anybody finds out that I'm Native. And a lot of times they'll ask me if I'm Mexican or do you speak Spanish, so you get money from the government. They almost say it before they mean to. So you get money from the... and they, you know, like it comes out immediately, like casino. They just want to say like things that comes up.
Right.
Because I think there's like this inherent guilt that we don't address, which also is part of the convenience to thinking we're not here or there's a historic. Only historically are we thought of, or where our heads are on jerseys and, you know. So not only am I fascinated by technology in the future, and I think Native people who've been living a post-apocalyptic world the longest of anybody, Indigenous people in general, we want the future more than anybody. We're ready to say goodbye to the past. We want to move forward. I wanted the texture of the novel to feel like now as a resistance to the narrative that gets spread of us only existing in the past. So I wanted to explore internet culture and, you know, drone technology. And I wanted people to be thinking about TV and being on the internet and being trapped in the internet and being on YouTube and... I was doing that very purposefully to resist what is the, you know, the default narrative about Native people, which is historical. And at best, there's a reservation update. But, you know, you probably have to be in the Native world to even understand that reference. Mostly it's just, you guys are still here.
Yeah. You know, one of my good friends, Leanne Howe, you know, she's a... she's doesn't hold back, you know. And I remember one time we taught together at Illinois, where the chief Illini, was a controversial figure there. And at one point, I remember she said to me, "Oh my God, can you believe somebody just came up to me, one of my students, because I was talking about Native Americans." She said, I don't understand what the complaint is. I don't understand what the fear is. I mean, you're alive, aren't you? You're still here, aren't you?" And I said, "Really? Well, why'd you tell her?" And I said, well, the only advice that I can give, and it's up to them after that, whether or not they're going to follow it, is I told her, read a book, right? Mm-hmm. Read a book. And I think that that, you know, and here in this, a number of these characters are trying to find that book, right? Whether it's an actual book or whether it's on video or audio, or whether it's going to the powwow, right? It's like that's the book that mm-hmm. is going to ground them, you know, into this very tumultuous landscape. Look at my notes here. So here's a good one. You know, you don't hold back either, in terms of addressing the issues and problems that afflict Native American community. I mean, you talk about the outside, you talk about the racism, you talk about all of that, but you also deal with some interior, you know, issues with the suicide rate, the alcoholism, the drug addiction, right, mental illness. And you really tap into all of that. And, you know, when I read the book, I see it as a very complex conversation. It's not a matter of just putting things to the left or the right, or good or bad or wrong, or it's really just the nuance of it, right? So, and on page 137 here, I'm going to look at my notes, there's an interesting passage that I think, this is where I get to, like, to the misinterpretations, I think, of when Native American or any minority writer writes and uses the term white people and what that leads to. So I want you to read this section here, that's the paragraph.
Just the underline. Yeah.
Oh, just the whole paragraph.
Of all the way down, the line. The wound that was made when white people came and took all that they took has never healed. An unattended wound gets infected, becomes a new kind of wound, like the history of what actually happened became a new kind of history. All these stories that we haven't been telling all this time, that we haven't been listening to, are just part of what we need to heal. Not that we're broken. And don't make the mistake of calling us resilient. To not have been destroyed, to not have given up, to have survived is no badge of honor. Would you call an attempted murder victim resilient?
And that, you know... Okay. It's a very startling moment, because if I read that passage, say, with the speaker addressing a white audience or the speaker addressing an Native American audience, I get a very different sense of calls to responsibility, right? And then I see the entire project, the entire book, as that, as a calling out, right? So what, for you, what is it that you were hoping? Because I think that as writers, we want our book to be part of the change in the world, right? But for you, what is it when you were first sort of moving into this territory and writing this particular book, what were some of your hopes for it?
Well, I think the initial impulse was to write this thing where it was both scary and free feeling, because there was nothing else written. So I felt like I could, with form and with how I would write about it, it was scary because there was nobody I could sort of measure myself by. But, you know, and then free because then I could do what I wanted.
Right.
What I wanted was just to represent Oakland as best I could and the urban Native life. But, you know, as a lot of people that know me who have read the book, it's stuff that eats me up, that I care about, that I talk about, that I, you know, somebody said somewhere, I don't know who, like, your first novel is like everything that you have wanted to, or that you've thought about,
mm-hmm.
you put it in that. And in some ways, you know, I worked in the urban Indian community in Oakland for 10 years, and just being in the community and dealing with all the issues and everything that I brought from my childhood and everything that my dad, that I inherited from my dad and my mom, like, and everything about the shame of or the coming to terms with being half white and half Native, and figuring out what that means identity-wise, like all of the tumultuous relationship of self that I've had to come to terms with, and trying to come out of that with a sense of pride, or at least like I've retained some cohesion,
yeah,
to be able to voice something that has a singular vision. I was trying to say through characters that to me like emerged from a fog of I don't know what. I mean, wherever they come from.
Yeah. What are you reading now?
You?
Well, thank you.
His newest book, I'm blown away by. Just finishing R.O. Kwan's The Incendiaries.
The Incendiaries?
Uh-huh. It's really good. I'm rereading Ocean Vuong's Night Sky with Exit Wounds. I'm very new to poetry, and I feel like a baby. But I know to follow my instincts with reading, and because I was never told by anybody to read.
Yeah.
And I just love what he's doing. And I'm actually rereading House on Mango Street.
Really?
Yeah. That thing just is bursting with life.
Right. And it's so timeless.
Yeah.
Right? It's so timeless, even though it's set in a very specific, it's a 1950s Chicago, and with a very specific young woman. And yet somehow, you know, sort of, I think it was one of the first books to sort of challenge the notion of, oh, well, who's going to read about this little, you know, Mexican girl in Chicago? It's like, are non-Mexicans going to read? Are non-girls going to read? Mm-hmm. And here we are, you know, still reading the book. I mean, the book, I believe, is one of the top sellers, apart from To Kill a Mockingbird, which is another one of my favorites as well, Harper Lee, To Kill a Mockingbird, and yet still there's something that continues to resonate, you know, with that book, and that's also a beautiful thing, right? To know that a book, here's this book published this year, but it'll be around 5 years from now, and somebody who really needs it 5 years from now is gonna grab that, right? And then 10 years from now, 50, and you hope 50 years from now, right? The way that you've been reaching out to the Latin American writers, many who are already passed on, is like, and that's probably the most magical thing about being a writer, right? I mean, are these things slowly sinking in, Mr. Writer? Because, I mean, it puts a pressure on. I mean, you know, now that you're writing the second one, it's like, not only you have to write a book, you have to make it good, right? But yeah, it's a good pressure. Go ahead.
No, I never thought of it like that. And it speaks to the power of the book as technology,
yes,
that actually transcends a lot of the required updated technology that we have.
Yeah.
Because, like you said, this, I don't know about this, but, you know, books can last 10 years, same exact book, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, you know.
Right.
Same exact book. And technology is a little bit more, who knows? So that's actually great to think about. I don't know about anything with the me, Mr. Writer, whatever.
Why are you? You gotta embrace it. You can't be afraid of it. I think that, seriously, it's there are things that you have no control over, right? You have no control over whether or not people are going to buy your book, or people are going to make it a bestseller, or whether it's going to be an award. You already exercised the control that you had, which was putting it out there in the world, right? That's it. And you just kind of let it go. And then whatever comes, whatever rewards come with it, it's just icing on the cake. Because you already did the hard part. You wrote it. That was the hard part. You know that.
Well, I feel so indebted to what literature has done for me, that every effort that went into this has felt like I just want to try to give back as much as I can to that world that I got so much from and continue to get so much from. So I don't know where to go from there, but that's where it came from. Like, just, you know, I'll always feel indebted to what books do.
We're going to have to wind up the interview before we take questions from the audience, or I think we're going to get some questions that are going to be submitted to me, I believe, in a minute.
Are you going to float me a question while you...
I'm going to float you a question while those cards are being submitted, if there are cards out there.
I think people are just not writing their questions.
Oh, you're just not writing your questions? People. That's how we used to do homework, right?
That's why deadlines are important.
That's why deadlines are important. To me, that wasn't clear. But where are you off to next?
Going to Chicago.
I love it. Tomorrow. I love shopping in Chicago. Some good shopping there.
I've only been there once.
I'll hook you up with my tailor. It's on Michigan.
You might have to give me that contact.
Yeah. He'll make you a good deal. Yeah. He's the one that bought me, that sold me this pin. I wore it for you because it's orange.
Okay, change of plan. We're going to do a live Q&A.
Oh, we're going to do a live Q&A.
Oh, we switched it up.
Okay, so am I going to? Oh, you eye color. Oh, me. Okay, this is going to be interesting because I'm like nearsighted, but I really can't see. But anyway, are there any... Anybody have a burning question? Okay, thank you. Uh-oh.
Hello. I haven't read the book yet, but I'm very excited. And I was just curious, you had said that part of the impetus to write this book was to represent urban native community, but then also represent Oakland. How do you feel like you did? And that seems like a big responsibility.
So... I have cried in public three times. Two of the times, a woman from the Oakland Native community showed up to my reading. The first time, she had only heard about the book. And she stood up and sort of spoke for 5 minutes about how amazing it was just that the phenomenon of the book had happened. And, like, you know, just already was in public just giving me praise for doing that. And so I cried. And then she showed up to another reading after she had read the book and gave another big speech. And I cried again. So there have been certain key people from Oakland, both native and non-native, who have given me the... In Cheyenne, there's a thing that I learned before I could speak. You go like this. You say pivot, and it's like, it's good. So I've gotten that from the people that matter to me most.
I think there's a hand down here. Wait till the mic, that way we can hear you.
Thank you so much for being here. Me and my friends, we were part of a book club, and this was one of our favorites.
Nice.
And we have a question. Actually, my friend does. Well, we all had it because we discussed it.
Okay.
We discussed it together. So we like the fact that you focus on generational relationships between younger men and their grandmothers or aunties. So we were wondering why there was a skipping of the generation, where it's like, I think I understand why, but I would like to know more of, like, why the focus on these younger men, you know, urban native men and their grandmothers and aunties, and how important that role was of their relationships.
I think it's just a common story that happens. And I think there's a certain generation where, because of, you know, you could point to different things, but... you know, they talk about seven generations and different levels of healing and where it happens. And there's definitely generations that took it harder, and boarding school generations and the children of boarding school generations and the generations that took what happened in certain ways could not be there for their children and were raised by their grandparents or raised by their aunties. Or, you know, there's a certain generation that was hit hard and acutely in a certain way, where they weren't able to be parents. So that just felt true of my experience and the community that I know, and that's why I wanted to do it that way.
Is there, maybe, okay, get back there. We'll get to you.
Hi, Tommy, I'm Maureen Moore. It's great to meet you. I just wondered how, for you personally, writing this book, has changed, if it has changed, your relationship to the community that you identify with and how your community has responded to it.
So I don't think it's changed anything. One of the coolest things that happened right away, I had a reading at City Lights, which is one of my favorite bookstores of all time. I was invited to speak for like six students graduating high school through the American Indian Child Resource Center out of Oakland, which who I've done work for over the years. They wanted me to be their keynote speaker. So right before my City Lights event, I got to be the keynote speaker. So casual and so late and so, you know, all over the place and just like the community is. I was like very honored to do that. I hate speaking in public, but you know, I've accepted that I should. And so that was, you know, everyone's response was great, and the fact that they want me to be there. And then as soon as I got back from the book tour, I was invited to, through the same organization, to the first Native American Heritage Night at the Oakland Coliseum, which it's only ever been through the Giants, and I helped with two different years. I helped with organizing the Native American Heritage Night for the Giants. First time Oakland Coliseum A's, day after we get back, and I'm watching powwow dancers on the field. Mm-hmm. And if you've read the book, then you can know that's a surreal moment. So I don't know that the book has changed my relationship, except that the community has embraced me. For the Friendship House in Oakland, which is another big organization, I've invited to be their sort of keynote speaker for their 63rd annual celebration of them being around, 63 years of this Indian Center in Oakland. This is an urban Indian hub. It's probably the oldest in Oakland, and they want me to come do the thing, and that feels great. I mean, that I've worked with them for many years, too. So I've been a part of the community for over 10 years, and the fact that, you know, I've been embraced and people have actually read the book feels wonderful.
There was a hand back here.
Hi, Tommy.
Hi.
At the Institute of American Indian Arts, it was such a thrill to see you moving into the role of mentor, formal role, mentor and professor. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about both sides of that coin. Who were your mentors and what it's like for you to be that mentor for writers coming up now?
So, interestingly enough, at the Institute of American Indian Arts, where I got my MFA, I ended up having zero Native mentors. And, you know, it's like a mix of Native and non-Native, and the faculty is wonderful. But I feel like there's a sort of intangible or non-entity mentor, which is your peer group and the spirit of the school, which was the biggest part of my experience, which is to be around other Native writers who are thinking about the same things and care about the same things. Being a part of a body of writers who you never knew existed, who were doing the same thing as you, was probably the biggest teacher for me there. I mean, I had wonderful support and learned a lot from all the teachers that I learned from there, but it was the communal experience and the emphasis on Native writing, and that it can matter and that it can be paid attention to and that people care about it.
There's also mentors on the page, right? The people that inspire us, who we read, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tommy, thank you. Thank you for a beautiful book. And I want to thank you in particular for one of your characters, Bill, and when you're describing what he read in prison, you brought up Oscar Zeta Acosta.
Yes. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yes. Chicano power. That's right.
I love his books.
Hello, this has been a great interview thus far. When you spoke about the book being kind of an archive that can last for X amount of time, when you do that, when you're writing that piece of work, do you have an idea of maybe a certain kid's hand or eyes that are going to at some point come over and grab it? Did you have a specific child maybe in mind? And if so, what were you maybe hoping they would take away from it?
I tend to think of the novel. I mean, I love the idea, the possibility of further reading. I tend to think of the novel as now, as new. That's what the name means. And I like novels that deal with what's happening now and that feel like now. So I don't tend to think of the future, and I was never thinking, like, I hope people read me later on. Like, I hope people read me now, and I never write thinking into the future.
Yeah. But I think, connotation there is that, yes, we are reading you now, and that's maybe, it's not always a given, but we are. But, you're going to be your writer, your kind of writer, but I'm just going to throw a little on-the-spot, on-stage mentorship right now and say, embrace that notion, because when you imagine a reader 10, 15, 20 years from now, I hope that along with that, you also imagine you as a writer 10, 15, 20 years from now as well. So I think that kind of looking past, looking beyond, is you're not only placing what you wrote in the past, right, and your future readers, but also you're placing yourself there as well. So that's just something to think about. Yeah.
And I appreciate that. I'm just so doom and gloom about the future.
Okay. Well, that's another stage, another moment. I think we have a hand up there.
Hi. You mentioned being in the now. I'd like to see or ask about how you think the novel fits with the novel about Oakland, that's really centered around Oakland and plots out streets and corners. And for me, as someone who has lived there, I could tell, I know exactly where that is. How the novel fits with. Like films, like most recently Boots Riley's film, or even like Fruitvale Station, or that there's someone like Mahershala Ali from Hayward.
Do you see Blindspotting?
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh.
Okay, but that there's eyes on Oakland that you're saying of the now that in the last our recent memory that there's been these stories told at least in the film about Oakland, and then reading your novel, I haven't finished it yet. So I'm glad you didn't really say too much about the ending, but that there are eyes in Oakland, that there's stories to be told in Oakland that are emerging from Oakland, and where you think this novel fits within that emerging tradition.
I mean, I think wanting to write the urban Indian story, like Native people have been living 70% of Native people have been living in cities for the past decade or more. There's no Oakland novels written. I wanted to represent both of those things. How it fits in now is not that much different than how it would have fit in if I tried to write it 5 years ago, except that, I'm touching on things like gentrification, how they relate to colonization, and some of these other writers or filmmakers are touching on these same things because it's been affecting Oakland for the past 10 years. I mean, they started writing Blindspotting 10 years ago, and a lot of the themes just fit because it's the same thing going on. So how it fits, it fits in that some of these stories that are being heard haven't been told or heard, and same with mine. It fits within a political climate where people are wanting to hear what hasn't been heard because the loud and nasty narrative that they want us to believe is the one that matters is so vile that we're like very open to hearing, like, oh wait, what else is going on?
I think we have time for one more question. There's somebody down here. The microphone's coming around.
I just want to say that I identified with a lot of your characters in the book because my parents' generation, they were really embarrassed about being Indigenous. My mother, in particular, that time, that place in our country's history, it was not smiled upon to be Indigenous. You were other, you were marginalized. And, but yet, even though I was raised with very little Indigenous exposure, as an adult, I found myself drawn to the culture, to the artwork, to the performance, to all of those parts that really had a strong resonance with me that I think I must have carried in my DNA regardless. Mm-hmm. But I guess as I look forward, I hope that urban Indians can find resources to amplify their desire for connection, for culture, for mm-hmm. identity. And I'm not sure how that's going to play out. It seems like there's a lot of homogenization that's going on in cities, in major metropolitan areas. Mm-hmm. So I'm hopeful, but I don't know. And I guess I'd like to hear your take on that.
I'm hopeful, but I don't know is how I feel about everything. I think this generation is much more curious and there's no shame-tinged piece to the way they conceptualize the idea of learning about their culture. So my dad, he didn't speak English or see a white person until he was five. But he raised us in Oakland, and my mom is white. And he didn't raise us with, even though he's fluent, he didn't raise us with our language because it was that time of assimilation as better. So we're in a different time now, and people are trying to revitalize language. My sister just became fluent after, you know, weren't raised that way. She moved back to Oklahoma, and we're all working together to try to revitalize the language because so much of culture is embedded in language. So much value of culture is embedded with language and cannot be separated from it. So I hope that these things can be valued, but the homogenization and the way technology moves and how desirable watching YouTube is seems to be for young people and loving certain YouTube personalities, the sort of cultish devoted nature of the internet and all its many tentacles. I'm hopeful, but I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much.
Aloud is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, the Los Angeles County Arts Commission, the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, Cecilia and Jeffrey Glassman, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and individual Library Foundation members. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.